Thanks again for leading us, praise team. Why don't we turn in our Bibles this morning to Genesis 34 as we look at the next episode in the life of Jacob. I thought this week about a day in my life when I was probably 7 or 8 years old, maybe 9. I was over at my grandparents' house with a couple cousins. My grandpa took us to the local elementary school to play on the playground there. And as a little kid, you know, these playgrounds they have just look huge, right? It's sprawled out across a field. They look enormous. They're really exciting. So we got there, and I remember taking off running because I saw kind of this gap in the playground. There were two wooden posts. I thought this is kind of like an entryway. I'm going to take off and get to this awesome sprawling playscape. And then I noticed something. I noticed that I was lying on my back in a mud puddle. And then I looked up and saw a chin-up bar. It was perfectly placed about right here at my 8 or 9 year old self. I had looked straight over it at the playscape and run full speed. Smacked my face right there on this bar. It's not a good day. I tell you that story because this chapter in the life of Jacob is going to do that to us. It's going to hit us hard. The only difference is this time it's not so funny. I don't know what it is about us. Thinking about an 8-year-old bleeding in a mud puddle is kind of funny. Chapter 34 of Genesis gives us no humor. There's been humor in past stories in little ways in the life of Jacob, but there's none here. It's really a shocking passage. Things have been going really well for Jacob. Last week we saw him at the high point in the narrative of his life. And here, one chapter later, maybe we see him at his lowest low. So if you're there in Genesis 34, I'd invite you to follow along as I read. We'll read the whole chapter together. Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to see the women of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he seized her and lay with her and humiliated her. And his soul was drawn to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob. He loved the young woman and spoke tenderly to her. So Shechem spoke to his father, Hamor, saying, "Get me this girl for my wife." Now Jacob heard that he had defiled his daughter Dinah, but his sons were with his livestock in the field. So Jacob held his peace until they came. And Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. The sons of Jacob had come in from the field as soon as they heard of it, and the men were indignant and very angry because he had done an outrageous thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing must not be done. But Hamor spoke with them, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him to be his wife. Make marriages with us. Give your daughters to us and take our daughters for yourselves. You shall dwell with us and the land shall be open to you. Dwell and trade in it and get property in it." Shechem also said to her father and to her brothers, "Let me find favor in your eyes, and whatever you say to me I will give. Ask me for as great a bride price and gift as you will, and I will give whatever you say to me. Only give me the young woman to be my wife." The sons of Jacob answered Shechem and his father Hamor deceitfully because he had defiled their sister Dinah. They said to them, "We cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a disgrace to us. Only on this condition will we agree with you, that you will become as we are, by every male among you being circumcised. Then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters to ourselves, and we will dwell with you and become one people. But if you will not listen to us and be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and we will be gone." Their words pleased Hamor and Hamor's son Shechem, and the young man did not delay to do the thing, because he delighted in Jacob's daughter. Now he was the most honored of all his father's house, so Hamor and his son Shechem came to the gate of their city and spoke to the men of their city, saying, "These men are at peace with us. Let them dwell in the land and trade in it, For behold, the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters as wives, and let us give them our daughters. Only on this condition will the men agree to dwell with us, to become one people, when every male among us is circumcised as they are circumcised. Will not their livestock, their property, and all their beasts be ours? Only let us agree with them, and they will dwell with us. And all who went out of the gate of his city listened to Hamor and his son Shechem, and every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of his city. On the third day, when they were sore, two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, took their swords and came against the city while it felt secure and killed all the males. They killed Hamor and his son Shechem with the sword and took Dinah out of Shechem's house and went away. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain and plundered the city because they had defiled their sister. They took their flocks and their herds, their donkeys, and whatever was in the city and in the field. All their wealth, all their little ones and their wives, all that was in the houses, they captured and plundered. And Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You have brought trouble on me by making me stink to the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites and the Perizzites. My numbers are few, and if they gather themselves against me and attack me, I shall be destroyed, both I and my household." But they said, "Should he treat our sister like a prostitute?" Stunning passage, confusing passage. Let's take a moment to unpack what we've just read. The passage here in Genesis 34 is pretty neatly structured. There are two acts of violence, and each one is followed by reactions to those actions. So the first violent act we read about, we have Shechem, the prince of the city of Shechem, and the whole region around it, where Jacob has been staying, and Shechem assaults Dinah, Jacob's daughter. Later on in the chapter, we find out that he's also holding her captive. Because we saw the brothers go, and when they attacked the city, they had to free her as well. An act of terrible violence. Now let's be clear here, just to show you how messed up the situation is. Let's talk about Dinah for a second. Shechem is obviously guilty, but Dinah isn't exactly totally innocent here either. Verse 1. Dinah went out. That's her first mistake. She went out. That simply would not have been allowed in this day and age. This was a dangerous place that Jacob was living in. It was a violent world, so any respectable family would have had standards in place where women, young women, would not have been allowed to just leave. And so she went out to see the women of the land. At first, this might sound like, you know, she's staying safe. She's just staying with the women. But think back to who these women are. Think back to Esau's wives in the groups of people surrounding the promised land. Esau's wives had made life bitter for his parents. His mother had said, "I'd rather die than see my other son marry these women too." These were women who practiced idolatry, immorality, and Dinah sneaks out of her house to go hang out with these women. I'm not saying she's guilty of what Shechem did. I'm just saying there was something very wrong from the start of this story. Dinah should not have been in any position to be anywhere near where she was. But she was, and she was brutally attacked. That was the first act of violence. And we see Jacob's reaction in verse 5. His reaction might be worse than the crime that was committed. It says he heard that he had defiled his daughter Dinah. It says, but his sons were with his livestock in the field. So Jacob held his peace. Jacob doesn't seem to care at all at this point. Maybe it's because Dinah was Leah's daughter. Maybe Jacob had past difficulties with her. We don't know. The passage doesn't tell us why Jacob doesn't care. But whatever the reason, he is presented as a complete coward here. He might have this excuse, right? Oh, my sons are out in the field. I better wait for them. Dad's here. If you have a daughter, wouldn't you be heading out to the fields to get your sons? Jacob's sons react as well, especially the sons who were Dinah's full brothers. It's quite a contrast between their reaction and Jacob's. Look down to verse 7. It said they were indignant, very angry, because he had done an outrageous thing in Israel. Quite a contrast. Now, there's this weird dynamic going on. I'm sure you caught it as we read. Shechem commits this awful crime, but soon after, he becomes infatuated with Dinah, wants to marry her. It seems that he can't tell the difference between love and lust. But Hamor, his father, has the gall to show up at Jacob's front door, right? He speaks to Jacob and to Dinah's brothers and suggests marriage. He makes this proposal. Hey, we'll become one people. Again, fathers here who have daughters, what would your answer be? Jacob says nothing. There's nothing written down here that Jacob spoke to Hamor. He's passive again. Either he's still afraid or maybe he's actually considering accepting this deal. The sons provide another huge contrast. They take action, and this sets up the second act of violence in our passage. See, we saw starting in verse 14, I think, verse 13, that Dinah's brothers initially play along. They act like they're going to accept this deal. They say to Hamor and Shechem, we'd love to go along with your plan, but we have this religious thing called circumcision, and it would be wrong to become one people if you're not willing to undergo that. Don't miss how treacherous that is. Circumcision was the sign of the covenant. For Dinah's brothers, it's an object of deceit. I mean, think of it this way. What if an atheist walked into our church and we said, hey, we welcome you. We want to baptize you. And we drown him. And I know that's kind of funny, but that's also incredibly sacrilegious. That's what Dinah's brothers, Jacob's sons, are doing here with this observance that God had given them. But Shechem is so in love, he falls for it right away, right? You remember the story that we just read. So they go home to their city. They talk up all the economic possibilities of this marriage arrangement. And they convince all the men of the city to undergo this. Because, look, we could get rich. That's what they're thinking. We could get really rich. But on the third day, it says in verse 25, the third day, Simeon and Levi attack. The third day, according to experts, the third day would have been the most painful point in the recovery after the procedure these men have undergone. On top of that, they probably would have had a fever at this point because of the circumcision. And at this point, Simeon and Levi take their vengeance. Every single man in the city is slaughtered. Absolute bloodbath. Right? I think sometimes we've read so much of Scripture, we read battle stories, we kind of lose a sense of what we're reading. It would be disturbing to witness this. Now, at first, that appeals to our sense of justice, right? But on second thought, and you think about the terror in the eyes of the women and the children in this city, we begin to realize that this punishment far outweighs the crime that was committed. That's not to diminish the crime at all. It's a terrible thing that Shechem did. But what Simeon and Levi are doing here, we have a word for it. It's called genocide. And after that, the other brothers come to clear out the city. They come for the loot. One scholar says they're like vultures circling above a corpse. Jacob reacts to this second act of violence too, in verse 30. Strangely, after the first act of violence, Jacob had nothing to say. But this time, he needs to have words. It might have been better if he hadn't said anything at all this time. because his response is completely self-centered. All he cares about is, oh, what's going to happen next? People aren't going to like me now. People might attack me now. You notice in verse 30. Let me read that verse again and emphasize a few words that show us the heart of Jacob's response. So Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You have brought trouble on me by making me stink to the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites and the Perizzites. My numbers are few, and if they gather themselves against me and attack me, I shall be destroyed, both I and my household." You catch all the me's, the my's, the I's? Jacob, once again, looks like a selfish coward. This looks like the old Jacob to us. He's got no concern for justice, only his own convenience going forward. So we read this chapter and we think, how the mighty have fallen, right? Last week, Jacob became Israel, which meant God shall rule. It's no accident that he's called Jacob over and over again in this chapter. He doesn't seek God. He doesn't trust God. He doesn't obey God. He doesn't even mention God throughout all of this ordeal. So like I said, this passage puts us flat on our backs. Here we are, lying in a scriptural mud puddle, trying to figure out what to do with this passage. And in the time that we have left, I want to ask three questions. These are the questions on your notes in the bulletin. To better understand the story, as we answer these questions, I think we're going to see that, strangely, this bizarre, disturbing chapter has a lot to say to us today. We wonder, what do we do with this passage? Why does God put stuff like this in his word? If you're confused, I sympathize with you. I've known this passage was coming for weeks, and I've been wondering, what do I do with this? There's actually some really important stuff for us to hear. So let's look at our first question. Simply this, how could this happen? How could this happen? You know, we live in a day and age where we're familiar with tragedy, right? You turn on the news, you hear about school shootings and Uber drivers and terrorists. And anytime anything like this happens, we start looking back and saying, were there any warning signs? Usually on the news, the answer is yes, and the same is true in the life of Jacob here. There were some serious warning signs. Let's look back to last week's chapter, 33. Look at verse 17. This is after God had saved Jacob's life by changing Esau's heart. Verse 17 says, "But Jacob journeyed to Succoth and built himself a house." Skipping ahead to verse 18, it says, "Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem." Those locations are a major warning sign for us. I didn't want to bring it up last week because it was the high point of Jacob's life. But Jacob had no business being there. Here's why. God had done some amazing things for him. He had been with Jacob throughout the whole Laban ordeal. He had caused Jacob to prosper. He had protected Jacob with the armies of heaven. He had given Jacob a new name. He had given him new integrity by humbling him. He had delivered him from Esau. All those things should take us back further in the life of Jacob. Go back to chapter 28, verse 20. Do you remember this passage? Jacob had this dream. He saw the ladder, the angels, and at the end of this experience, he had made a vow to God. Verse 20, "Then Jacob made a vow saying, 'If God will be with me,'" check that one off, God has been with him, "'and will keep me in this way that I go,'" check that one off, God has kept him, "'and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear,'" well, God has done a lot more than that, right? Jacob has become a rich man. Verse 21, "'so that I come again to my father's house in peace,'" check again. God had delivered him from Esau's wrath. "'Then the Lord shall be my God, And this stone which I have set up for a pillar shall be God's house. So Jacob had made a vow. In response to all God's promises, Jacob had said, God, if you fulfill these promises, I'm going to come right back here to this spot, to Bethel. And this rock that I've set up, he says, it'll be God's house. That's his way of saying, I'm going to come back to this exact spot and meet with God and center my whole life upon him. Think of the significance of God's house later in the life of the Israelites. It was the center of their whole society. Jacob promised that that's what his life would be like. He would go back to Bethel and live in that way if God would do these things. We saw last week that God had done these things. So Jacob should have gone full speed ahead to Bethel to fulfill his vow. But soon after he departed from Esau, he came to Succoth and to Shechem. Yeah, it looked like a good place for the flocks to graze. You know, he probably saw in Shechem the same things that Hamor had promised him. This was a great economic opportunity. So while he was right to worship God last week for all that God had done, he was also holding back his full obedience. He wasn't fulfilling his vow. And as I read many times this week, partial obedience is just a nice way of saying disobedience. Jacob is giving God partial worship in the passage we read last week. He wanted to hang on to the opportunities that these locations offered him instead of going where he promised and doing what he promised to do. You know, at the beginning of the life of Jacob, we read about Esau, and it said Esau despised his birthright. Well, there are shades of Esau here because Jacob appears to despise his covenant with God. A covenant. Let's talk about a covenant to make sure we all know what's being said here. A covenant is simply a binding agreement. And in the Bible, that usually takes place between God and human beings. It's kind of this two-way promise where God makes these promises to do all the hard parts for humans. And humans are called to respond to him by trusting him and obeying him. So for Jacob, the covenant that he had with God consisted of all the promises that we've been talking about every week, right? The promises to Abraham, descendants, land, that he would be a blessing. And in return, God asked Jacob to trust him and obey him, to live life on God's terms. And why wouldn't you want to live life on the same terms as this God who makes these promises? This covenant that Jacob had was an amazing demonstration of the grace of God. We know who Jacob is. We know what he's like. We know he's this deceiving con artist. We know he has no natural rights, right? Esau was the firstborn. Yet God chose him anyways and continually blessed him. But here in chapter 34, Jacob fails to see how precious this covenant was. He stopped protecting that covenant. He let his guard down. See, the people of Shechem, they were idolatrous. They were morally bankrupt. But this is the place that Jacob has chosen to settle down and build his life. Earlier we said from the get-go in chapter 34, something is wrong. That's what's wrong. Maybe this is why his daughter is out and about living dangerously, in a position to be taken advantage of. Maybe she's just following her dad's example. It brings an important word of caution to us this morning. Because we have a covenant that is equally as precious as Jacob's. In the upper room, Jesus said, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood." Jesus shed his blood so that undeserving people like us, simply by trusting that he died in our place, could be restored in a relationship with God. But how often do we fail to protect that covenant just like Jacob did? We're so quick to cozy up with the values, priorities, and assumptions of our culture. which don't always line up with what God has told us in His Word. There's so many examples of this, right? Right. A couple weeks ago, we talked about prosperity theology. People like, you know, Joel Osteen, Joyce Meyer, others who say that God just wants us to live the good life. Think about the way we, you know, our assumptions about marriage, right? So often within our churches, people just assume that I have a spouse who is there to support and complete me and make me happy. And when that doesn't happen, well, there's no point anymore. Let's just end it. Let's call it quits, get a divorce. It's rampant in our churches. We've done the exact same thing Jacob has done. Other examples. Man, I thought of one that seems kind of dumb compared to the other ones, but it hit me hard this week. Sports. For our kids, so often, we raise them to assume that sports take priority over their involvement in church. And as dads, so many men prioritize fandom over their families. Think about our sexual ethics. We take on the assumption of our culture that we're created as sexual beings for our own individual fulfillment. We leave out the part about a husband and wife expressing love to one another. So if it's all about me feeling good, then what's the big deal about where I go online, what novels I read, where my mind wanders? So many Christians fall into these traps. And you know what? The list could go on and on and on. The point is this. We have a covenant relationship with God that is precious. And if this passage reminds us of anything, it's that we need to protect that covenant. Because Jesus bought it with His blood. Don't throw it away like Jacob did. We only have 5 minutes left. We're not going to talk about our next two questions. I'd love to. They're really important. Because you know what? If we stop at this one point, which we have to, it kind of leaves us a little bit discouraged. Leaves us convicted. But maybe just to wrap up, I'll give you this. I'll give you a challenge. There is a seed of hope in this disturbing passage. It convicts us. It says, you're just like Jacob. In so many ways, we've failed to protect the covenant. We've become just like the world around us. But there's a seed of hope. I'm going to challenge you to look for that this week. If you can't find it, call me. I'll help you find it. Maybe I'll give you a book and you can find it. Find it there. But this passage does not leave us hanging. It points us in the right direction. It gives us the key to protecting the covenant. It gives us the strength we need to stand strong. I don't know how to end because we have two points left and I've only gotten through one. So my conclusion would not make sense. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to pray. I'd ask you to pray with me. And praise team, would you come and lead us out? God, we thank you for the preciousness of the relationship that you've given us with you. God, we thank you for passages in your word that turn us upside down, confuse us, cause us to come back to you on our knees and on our faces and to depend on you. And I pray that with just the small portion of this passage that we've looked at this morning, that you would convict us. That we would respond to you with repentance. That we would see the ways that we've cast aside our relationship with you and gone back to being who we used to be. May we dig deeper into your word this week and find the hope that is there. Realize that we don't need to live in guilt and shame, that because of you, we can be restored to this covenant once again. So Lord, help us to just be attentive to your Spirit, to respond correctly. And we ask in your name. Amen.